The past couple weeks, we've been in this series we're calling Seven Number One Reasons. If you ask 10 people, hey, so what's up with this Jesus story that's been going on for a couple thousand years now? Why did God send his son? Why did the Son of God come? What was Jesus' reason, his purpose for coming? You ask 5, you ask 10 people, you get 10, 15 different responses, or everybody says the same thing, and all of that is right. Because the New Testament paints Jesus as having come for various reasons, and it depends on who's telling you, and it depends on to whom the letter or the phrase is being said. And Jesus has come for this reason or this reason or this reason. And so for the past couple of weeks, we've been in this. Jesus says, I was sent to preach the good news of the kingdom. And Jesus in one place says, I didn't come to abolish the law and the prophets. I came to fulfill the law. And to that particular group of people, he says, here's the reason. Here is why I have come. And today, we thought we'd go light because we're going to deal with something that that John says in 1 John chapter 3. He says, the reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the devil's work. So if you've never been to Cross Point or it's been a while since you've been to church, we're going to talk about the devil. Hope that's all right with you. we recognize right away that when you look at that phrase, the reason Jesus appeared, the reason he came, in this particular context to the group of people John is writing to in 1 John, was to destroy the devil's work. Many of us, as soon as we see devil, something inside of us rolls its eyes, something inside of us laughs, something inside of us says, come on, let's not take it that far. We all grew out of the boogeyman. So we don't have to believe in the devil to become good Christian boys and girls, do we? Many of us, I don't buy it. Others of us, we're scared to admit that that's what's really going on inside of us because we think as soon as we tell the truth, a very high value to God, as soon as we tell the truth and admit that, man, I really don't believe in some of that, that somehow puts us in the devil's house. And so we continue to say that we believe things that we really don't believe. And so what we want you to know from the very outset here is that we recognize as soon as you see devil's work, as soon as you see devil, that you feel something inside of you want to check out. We're sensitive to that. We understand that. We acknowledge that. And what we want to say is what many of you have in your minds when you say, I don't believe in the devil. We would say, oh, no, we don't believe that either. Because frankly, here's what many of you are thinking of. The devil is apparently maybe Lebanese, Italian, half-brother of Father Guido Sarducci. I was realizing, backstage, I was realizing, hey, angels are always blonde. That doesn't seem fair to the brunettes, The devil's always a brunette, and he's got a mean receding hairline going on there, but the horns are probably doing that. So we look at this and we go, I expect to see that every October in the stores, but if I'm being honest, this is not an image that I'm going to cling to as representing reality. This is not the face of evil for me. This is something comical. It's something cartoon. And we want you to know, many of us, we carry images like this, there's some really scary images out there that have this kind of imagery, and we're being told that this is what we're supposed to believe, and you're not. That says more about pop culture and media and certain literary legends, the things that have been handed down to us, but it says more about that than a biblical picture of what the devil actually is. The images and the ideas that inform how we think about the devil or Satan, ha-satan, that's Hebrew for the accuser, diabolos is what's translated devil, and that's just the Greek version of the same thing, the slanderer, that which is opposed to God and to God's children. And so many of us, we have these images in our head, but the images aren't necessarily, they don't come from the Bible, they come from other various ways. Dante's Inferno has informed a lot of how we think about the devil and hell and that sort of thing. For some of us, it's through history, it's Baphomet. Others of us, and this is huge because Christians really adopted some of this imagery early on, it's Pan. It's the half-goat, half-man that already existed prior to Christianity. There's a whole religion, a cult religion that is around Pan. And Pan is the god of fertility. He's the god of the underworld. He's the reason that spring happens after winter occurs. Pan is the god of fright. That's where we get the word panic or fear, because if you think about what his mother experienced giving birth to this thing, obviously that would be, well, I guess it depends on breach or normal. Yeah. Like it could have been, oh, ah, or ah, oh. I don't know how it went, but that's where fear came from. I think we should spend more time on that, imagery.
Spend more time on what you didn't say. That's
yeah, all the stuff I left inside is fun too. So we have these images in our head, but we think, oh, I'm supposed to believe that and take myself seriously as an adult. They're not biblical. Those are not biblical images that are in our minds. It makes sense that sheep and goats in the New Testament are separated, and so, geez, the devil, Satan, has to be the ultimate goat, and so that horn and half goat imagery was easy to adopt, but it has the negative consequence of making us feel like it's the boogeyman, because all good stories have a boogeyman, right? And so, for many of us, it would be naive. It works for children, especially when we want to control behavior. But when we're adults, it'd be naive to believe that under the earth somewhere is God's enemy, and he's got horns, and he laughs maniacally every time somebody falls down. But that would be naive. Well, so we would agree. I would agree with that. But would be equally naive to say human beings are the only conscious entities that there are. You have to have a body and be a human to have a conscious experience. And there's plenty of evidence that that's not the case at all. And so it would be naive to say that. And so if we're being honest and we can open our minds a little bit, it makes sense that if we are spirits that are embodied, could there be disembodied spirits? Is that one way of defining what an angel is? And the scriptures over and over say that angels live among us, that they represent good things to us from God. In the New Testament, it even says, hey, you've entertained angels and you didn't realize it. And some of you are like, that's not just Bible. That's happened. When I needed somebody in my life at just the right moment, somebody stepped in and then stepped out. I never saw them again. I have no explanation for who that person was. I've heard those stories over and over. That angels are conscious creations of God that do his work. Well, that makes sense. If we can exist, they could exist. But wait a minute, don't they have free will? And if they do, can they choose not to uphold the way of God? And when they work against God, what are they? Well, that's the definition of a demon, of consciousness choosing itself and its own interests over others. And now suddenly, that has very human connotations. That's very easy to believe. And so as naive as goat man is to believe in, it'd be very naive to think that we are everything there is consciously. The Bible, throughout, from front to back, it vacillates between Satan, the devil, as being a force, an impersonal thing, as well as a person. And so the scripture that we just read from 1 John chapter 3 says that Jesus came to destroy not just the devil. Jesus came to destroy the works, which is impersonal. It's the sum total of the activities of the person, the devil. But Jesus came to destroy the force or the works, the evil ramifications of the devil.
That's pretty interesting when you read further on in the New Testament. Luke, one of the authors of one of the four accounts of the life of Jesus, records a conversation between Jesus and the devil, where it says that Jesus was led by God out into a desert where he fasted for 40 days. Presumably in preparation for the beginning of what would be an incredibly intense 3 years of public ministry for Jesus. So near the end of this 40 days of fasting, the devil comes and he begins tempting Jesus, placing these temptations in front of him. And in doing so, and by paying attention by what types of things the devil tempts Jesus with, we get a window into just how the enemy works. And how he works most aggressively in our lives, because you'd have to imagine that when he's tempting Jesus, I mean, he's bringing the strongest game he's got in trying to tempt the Son of God. Now, we don't have time to go through all the different layers of the conversation that goes back and forth, but I want us to look at a couple things. Luke chapter 4, verse 3, it says, "The devil said to Jesus, if you are the Son of God, tell this stone to become bread. Now, Jesus is obviously hungry. He's been fasting from food for 40 days. And so at first, this seems innocent enough. I mean, what's the big deal? All you have to do is, just do a little magic trick, Jesus, get yourself some food. But we talk about this a lot around here. When it comes to every temptation, there's always more at stake than what we think there is in the moment right in front of us. We think it's just about this one decision, this one choice, this one time. There's always much more at stake. And here the issue is much more than hunger for Jesus. And it's much more on whether or not he can do a miracle and get himself some food. And it's much more than simply a matter of willpower or self-control. And the way that Jesus responds to the devil shows that. Because in his response, what he starts to demonstrate is this idea that since God clearly led me here to this place, to this desert, to this time of fasting, what Jesus is wrestling through is, do I have confidence in God that he has my best interest in mind? Do I have confidence that he's aware of my needs, that his commands always lead to life? Or do I need to step outside of God's way? Do I need to step outside of God's leading and take matters into my own hands? You see, that's the temptation that's in front of Jesus. That's what's at stake. And understand, that's the very same question, the very same tension that we find behind every one of our temptations. Because we all struggle with temptation. It's not a sin to struggle with temptation. Jesus himself was tempted, obviously. In times we find ourselves hungering for things like intimacy or a promotion or financial gain or a hungering for comfort. And what we often don't realize is what's at stake in those moments is our confidence in God. And what can end up happening is we think, you know what, if I want to get a date or if I want to fit in with this crowd of friends or this group of friends, then I have to be willing to do certain things. I got to be willing to compromise morals and values. And if I want to fit in, then so you just do it. Or we think, if I've got to get this deal done, then I have to not disclose everything. I'm going to have to lie because that's just how this business works. That's how people make it in this business. And so you do it. Or we think, if I want to win, if I want to beat this other person out, then I have to bend the rules somewhat. Because if I don't, I'm just going to get stuck in this same lame situation the rest of my life. So you do it. And so we find ourselves very easily over time progressing to the point where we're doing things that aren't exactly ethical or in line with trusting God. And behind each of them is this very subtle but very real belief of, God, I don't think I can trust you. Because I don't think you're going to come through for me. Or we start to think, God, you know what? I don't think you care. Now, we don't start out that way. That's not how it starts. But it progresses over time. God, I don't even think you're concerned. Many of us, we default to this way of thinking of, you know what, God, if you're there at all, then I imagine that you're concerned with things like world peace. You're concerned with things like making sure planets don't collide with each other. But not about the details of my life. Not about the things that concern me the most. I'm sure you just think that's trivial. I don't think, God, I can trust you to meet my need for intimacy or for progress or for comfort or whatever it is that I'm hungering for. And so if it's going to happen, I've got to step outside of your ways. I've got to step outside of your leadership because this is how things get done in the real world. It's how we see it. You see, it's subtle, but that's exactly how the enemy works in our lives, slowly beginning to erode our trust in God, getting us to buy into lies. And all of a sudden, our view of God changes. We see another example of how the devil most often works a few verses later. Verse 9, it says, the devil led Jesus to Jerusalem, had him stand on the highest point of the temple. If you are the Son of God, he said, throw yourself down from here, for it is written. And so the devil here actually quotes scripture from the Old Testament. So he conveniently rips it out of its context to use for his own purposes. But he says, he will command his angels concerning you to guard you carefully. They will lift you up in their hands so that you will not strike your foot against a stone. Jesus answered, it says, do not put the Lord your God to the test. Jesus himself pulls from the Old Testament and references a story there in the Old Testament. He says, don't put the Lord your God to the test. And so basically what the tempter is saying to Jesus is, okay, you say you trust God, then prove it. Throw yourself down off the top of this temple and let the angels catch you. After all, Jesus, that's what the scripture says is going to happen. So if you really trust that God cares about you, prove it. Make God prove that he really loves you. But again, Jesus responds, don't put the Lord, your God, to the test. So here's how this plays out for us, where you find yourself saying things or thinking things like, you know what, God, you say you're good. So God, if you're really good, then you'll do this for me. Or God, you know what, if you really love me, you say that you do, if you really love me, then you'll make this thing happen. God, if you really exist, then you know what, you'll take care of this. If you really care about me, then you'll fix this. And so in very much the same way, here the devil says to Jesus, just jump. Prove it. I'll give you a plan. You just jump. After all, don't you trust him to bail you out? Why don't you test him? And you see, that's how trusting God often gets warped in our mind, because we start to think, okay, here's what I'll do. I'll come up with a plan. I'll pull the trigger on that plan. And if God's really there, then I'll trust that he's going to bail me out. Now, it doesn't matter who came up with the plan in our mind. And it doesn't matter if that plan is not aligned with God or if it's not aligned with the ways of God. We think, well, he's God. If God really loves me, if God really exists, he has to come through for me. If I say I have faith, if I say I believe, God's got to do what I say God has to do in order to meet my criteria. And so we end up marrying someone that doesn't share our values or beliefs. We don't prepare for the presentation at work. We don't study for the exam. We make poor financial decisions. We put ourselves in bad situations. And we think, you know what, God, you're going to bail me out of this, aren't you? After all, don't you love me? God, if you really love me, you'll fix this. And if God doesn't do our bidding, if God doesn't bless the plan that we come up with, if God doesn't act like some subservient genie the way we expect him to be, what ends up happening for many of us is we become very tempted to blame God. We get mad at God. We get disappointed in God. We somehow think God has failed us because he didn't make our plan happen. And so as a result of this progression, many times people stop believing in God. Or if they don't believe in God, stop believing God altogether, they at least stop believing that God actually cares about the details of their life. And it progresses to the point where God just becomes this distant idea. Maybe, sure, maybe he's out there somewhere, and this God, maybe I believe in this idea in another place floating above the clouds, but he's not someone who interacts with me. He's not someone whose leadership actually has any practical guidance or help for my daily life. And in doing so, in getting us to buy into these subtle lies, the devil is accomplishing some of his greatest works around us all the time.
That's good stuff, man. I'm sorry, I got lost in that a little bit, so I was forgot I wasn't sitting out there. Sorry. Oh, I'm on.
I've got to talk now.
I didn't share this the other 2 hours, but one of the thoughts I had is when we do this together, I always have to sit on your left side, and the etymology of the word sinister is left-handed, and so you just think about that. I didn't really have a point. I just.
Or I sit on your right side.
Which that okay, has yeah.
A lot of other biblical connotations.
There you go. Furthermore, I'm not sure. I need a segue. I feel like the weatherman. Speaking of Satan, cloudy skies tomorrow. How do you do this?
Third service gets the complete unedited right, yeah, version. Yeah, you know, sorry. Like,
I think I nodded off, to be honest. So with the points that you're raising, though, we're talking about these things, these temptations. This is all stuff we've already dealt with today, many of us, or within the last week. Invitations to give in to a desire for power or to put comfort up as the highest. Yeah, the highest value, or our own value system, our own principles that we would put up above the people that they directly affect. Many of us already today have fallen into the temptation to do exactly what Jonathan's talking about, and it leaves us thinking, well, wait a minute, wait. The text for today is that Jesus came to destroy the works of the devil. Don't we say Jesus did what he came to do? Wasn't he successful? Then why is that stuff still here? Because when I think of the word, I don't know what you think of, when I think of the word destroy, I think explode, like demolish, chemical change, no going back. It's gone. It doesn't say Jesus came to give the devil a good, swift talking to. He destroyed the works of the devil, and yet we're still very much tuned into the fact that temptation's real. The works of the devil, of anti-kingdom, selfish love, are still at play, and we've got regret that's just days old. So looking at that word destroy, that's translated from Greek, it's a very interesting word to me because in most every other place that it's used in Greek in the New Testament, it's translated differently than it's translated in this particular context. The Greek word translated destroy is the word leo. And most every other time that it's translated as untie or loosen or unbind. Like, go into the town and leo the colt from the post and bring it to me. Yeah, untie. Unbind, unwrap. But here it's destroy. And I think that destroy, I don't think destroy is wrong, but it puts a very specific kind of image in our head that makes us sound a little bit naive to the extent that we lift it up. Oh, there's no such thing as evil anymore. Jesus came and successfully destroyed it. And none of us believe that. Jesus came to destroy the works of the devil, but the works of the devil are still playing out at my kitchen table, let alone the world, if you watch the news. And so what does this mean? Now, when we put it up against untie, now suddenly a different or fuller picture of the word comes into play, and we recognize that somehow we have a responsibility to it, that somehow our choices affect it. Because what God has done from the beginning is said, I'm giving you this, all of creation, and it's very good. Back in Genesis, that's his reaction, emotional to it. He makes it and says it's very good. And then sin comes as a virus in a well body. And so Jesus coming to untie or unbind the devil's works, that's an image of Jesus saying there's something underneath this tarp, underneath this veil, and I want to untie it so you can see it for what it really is. I want to untie it so you can see you for who you really are. There is this thing, this circumstance. It's beautiful. There is latent glory here. And he comes and he unties it so that it can be seen for how it was intended to be. Think of it just this thing, and it's got a tarp, and Jesus walks around, and he unties, and he breaks, and he unbinds and loosens as he's walking around, and you and I, with perfectly good intentions, I'm not talking about bad guys now, I'm talking about you and me, we walk behind him going, nope, nope, we like it that way. See you at church. And so you're at the office, you're at the lunch table, or you're somewhere, you're at the game, and somebody's name comes up, and they're not present in the conversation, and it's obviously a moment where that person is getting slammed, made fun of, judged, you're hearing things you hope they never hear, and now you're starting to say things you would never say to them. And it's very clear to you, hey, I'm no theologian, but this is gossip. And Jesus came and said, I want to show you what real judgment looks like. If anybody was ever at liberty to judge somebody, it's me. And he comes in gentleness and in kindness, and he unties all of that. So real beauty between human beings, even when they're in different rooms or different zip codes, that real beauty between human beings could be seen. And we go, no, we've really gotten used to the other thing. And so knowing that that's been untied, you say, well, but this is going to draw me and them close, and so we'll have a common enemy. Our unity will be based on vilifying that person or judging them as subpar on some metric, and we retie what's been untied. Many of us know very, very much, very clear that bitterness is a terrible life, that a lack of forgiveness is ugly and it's a terrible way to go. And all of our favorite movies have redemption and forgiveness in them. And all the best sermons have redemption and forgiveness in them. And many of us, we've left going, man, think how many people called their mom on the way home and yay, forgiveness is so great. But the way I've been sinned against, Jesus unties it and we walk behind him and we retie it. I've grown to like it that way. I had a woman come up after second hour and she said she's held on to a forgiveness issue her whole life. She was abused for decades of her life from birth on. And she said that she was so scared of the idea of really forgiving, not just the words, but really saying the debt is canceled, and she never did it, and then the person died. And very recently, she asked God just to bring his face to mind. the best that she had now, and said, I'm literally going to cancel the debt. I'm not going to live in the past. I am more than the sum total of what happened to me. And she said, before she'd ever heard this sermon, she said, bands. She recognized it was kind of weird, but she said, in my mind, I could see bands breaking and unbinding in my mind. And I feel free. We know that that's beautiful, but Jesus, we like it that way. And we walk behind him and we retie what he's untied. Well, who am I without control? If I can't make you agree with me, if I can't get you, you know, to lift me up as the guy that's right. If I'm not the keeper of truth, I don't know who I am. And Jesus says, if anybody was ever right, it was me. But I go and I wash feet for people who will never get it right. I love them anyway. I've untied all of that. And we walk behind him and say, no, I'm not. That's too risky, too vulnerable. I've got to have control. And we rebind what he has made free. Then that's what happens between you and I. But what happens between our ears? We refuse to believe good things about ourselves. We were told some lies about who we are and as kids, and we held on to it. It's been reinforced intentionally or inadvertently by people that love us, reinforcing lies. We only believe lies about ourselves. And Jesus over and over wants us to know something beautiful about ourselves. If you only saw what I could see. No, I've really gotten used to seeing myself this way. And we retie what he has unbinded. It happens on a macro scale. What happens when these kinds of people get together and form communities, churches, cities, nations, where they have an opportunity to continue to uphold what has been unbinded, and they don't? Racism, a great example. Racism at its core is simply something you were told in a lack or presence of melanin. It's indefensible, and yet that doesn't make it any less real. And Jesus, over and over in the New Testament, says, I'm making the two one. That which divides you isn't there. Redemption, unity, love. You are one blood. You are all God's children. You are brothers and sisters. The earth is one big house. And we say, that's beautiful, but we tie back on by forwarding that stupid email, by continuing to embrace ideas that make it us and them, and we retie what he has untied. And greed, it's always greed when it's somebody else. For me, it's achievement and success, but you, it's greed. And politics, when they get really, really bad. And nationalism and tribalism, where two nations are fighting as though they're different. This happens in churches where my God is better than your God, or our interpretation of God and all that comes with God is more true, better, right than your interpretation of all of that. And on a macro scale, it's the schemes of devil. It's the schemes of selfishness and anti-kingdom and self-pointed love. And Jesus came to untie all of that, and we walk behind him, tying it back up. And so the question becomes, then what do we do with ourselves when we find ourselves tying what Jesus loosed? Or better, what do we do with those that tie what Jesus has loosed? Should we protect Jesus's work? Should we wage war against those that do more for the works of the devil than the works of Christ? Should we call enemy and attack all those that disagree with us because they don't understand that we're of the people who are about freedom? Who's the enemy in this scheme?
So as we wrestle with that question, we got to pay attention to something that Paul writes in the book of Ephesians. He writes to a group of Christians in a city called Ephesus. Right, says Ephesians chapter 6, verse 10. He says, finally, be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power. Put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. And as we wrestle through that question that, you know, Steve just left us with, one of the realities we have to constantly keep in front of us is exactly what Paul says there in verse 12, that our struggle is not against flesh and blood, that our struggle is not ultimately against other people. but that there's a much more significant war being waged. Now, you need to hear me that I don't pretend, nor do we pretend, to understand all the mystical nuances of that reality. But what I do know is that when we only see ourselves pitted against other individuals in a conflict, whether that's a spouse or a child or a friend or someone we've labeled as an outsider or deemed as an enemy, or when we only see ourselves pitted against certain groups of people, certain types of people, certain communities of people, or nations of people in a particular conflict, and we choose to direct all of our anger and energy and resources and time toward conquering those people or marginalizing those people, when we do that without asking bigger questions, without asking what kind of struggle is actually going on beyond what we see right in front of us in the flesh, without pausing to realize, long enough to realize who our battle is ultimately always with. Understand, we play right into the schemes of the devil, to the works of the devil. We bind it back up, what Jesus has loosened. And understand, I hope you hear my heart on this, I'm by no means suggesting that there's not room for appropriate boundaries and consequences for people when they choose to sin. This isn't about being Pollyanna about people who commit grievous crimes, especially when we, you know, stuff that we see on TV or we see in the newspaper, or many of us have been confronted with personally, with people acting out in revolting and disturbing and gut-wrenching ways against innocent people or against children. But what I am suggesting is that love and loving people is extremely difficult. It is incredibly hard. And we can't allow ourselves to be so narrow in our understanding and in our reactions to one another and to other people and to other groups of people and types of people and nations of people that we neglect what's actually going on beyond what we can necessarily see in front of us. And so we have to discipline our hearts and we have to discipline our minds to ask bigger questions about what's going on. And ultimately, we have to ask more important questions.
So a couple weeks ago, we were in a series, James, and I want to go back to that because James is asking some really tough questions about how difficult love is in real life. Love is a beautiful concept, and everybody agrees with it in here, but how do you go love? How do you go love people that have been hurtful? How do you actually employ love in the real world? And James talks about that, and he says something that I think is both literal and metaphoric at the same time. He finishes chapter 1 with this: religion that God, our Father, accepts as pure and faultless is this: look after orphans and widows in their distress and keep yourself from being polluted or stained by the world. So what is real religion? Is it us and we're against them? No. Your war isn't with flesh and blood. There's a binding and a tying and a total lack of freedom inside people's minds, between people, between nations. You want to know what real religion is? You go celebrate that which has been unbound. You become one who stands beside Jesus, unbinding that which is bound. And you love those with or without their ability to love you back. Widows and orphans. Literally, widows and orphans, but figuratively, because it's got to include men. I mean, there would be homeless men in that equation too. But in his society, who had a less ability to pay you back? Loving people is something that you give them. You don't trade love. You don't negotiate or sell love. Love is something that you give with no expectation of return. It's nice when it happens, but that's not why we do it. Real religion, the spotless, faultless, pure kind that God is after, it's none of the ways that rules have been handed to people to keep the us and them distinction clear. Real religion is about giving yourself the way Christ gave himself to the world, to free it through the power of love. The word religion has some interesting background to it. And one of the oldest etymologies of the word religion comes from the words religare. You can hear ligament or ligature. It's something that ties things together or binds things. And so religature is the background and the root of religion that has traditionally been thought to mean binding yourselves again to God. And so what we're talking about today is not, hey, don't bind things when Jesus has unbound it. The issue is partnering with him in freeing the world to be seen as it was intended, while properly binding ourselves to those he loves and to him. And once again, we're back to love God and love people. Real religion isn't about waging war against people. It's waging war for them, and that's hard. And it's not something you do just because you really, really want to. It's something that the Spirit of God gives us beyond our own means to do. But real religion, pure and undefiled religion in God's sight, is about partnering with Jesus to go love people, recognizing that what they need is to be loosed, not attacked. And it's hard. But we have to ask, are we people who properly bind and unbind in the name of Jesus, or do we in our own fear, on purpose or inadvertently, partner with a devil whose works are being destroyed as we speak?
So here's how I want us to wrap this up. At the very end of the scriptures in the book of Revelation, God gives John, the author, a picture of what's to come, of what everything has been moving toward. And John writes this vision down and records it in Revelation chapter 21. He says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea." Now, just to pause there for a moment so it doesn't throw anyone, because sometimes we get this idea of, what, there's no oceans, there's no water, there's no lakes, and we have to remember that, you know.
No fishing, enjoy your stay.
That's right. But that John, when he's writing this, he's in exile on an island. And so his isolation from all that he knows and loves and people is caused by the sea. And so he's using imagery, as he does all throughout the letter of Revelation, that there will no longer be any separation in the new heaven and the new earth. So he writes, "I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes, and there will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away.' He who was seated on the throne," this picture of Jesus, "said, 'I am making everything new.'" Now, this word "new" it's important, because when we think of the word "new," many times we think of it's never been existed. It's never existed before. And there was a word in Greek for that. It's the word neos. But that's not the word that John uses here. He uses a different word that gets translated as "new" in English, and it's the word kainos. And it doesn't mean never existed before, but rather it means refreshed. It carries with it this idea of stripping away all that has marred what was originally created, what God originally intended, and restoring it to what it was meant to be in the first place. Of untying the works of the devil and rebinding it and rebinding us to grace, to truth, to love, and most importantly, to himself. And ever since sin entered into the world, you got to understand that's what God's been up to. Restoring, redeeming, resurrecting everything and everyone that has been marred by sin. And that's the same story that Jesus invites us into. To share, to partner with him with, of bringing heaven here the way God has always intended it to be, to live life in the kingdom of God under his trusted leadership. And so my hope is that as we leave here today, as individuals, as families, as friends, as groups of people, as a community, as a whole, that we would link arms together and we'd be the kind of people that wouldn't go around retying what Jesus has already loosened. That we wouldn't buy into the lies of the devil and further his works in this world. But rather we would bind ourselves to him, and that we would participate in the resurrection that God desires to do in us and desires to do through us for the whole world. And so with that, may we leave here today and go in peace. And be a part of that resurrection. Have a great week. We'll see you next Sunday.